The slides are just for the first part, maybe half or a little less of the talk, so that I amortize my work and another talk.
Okay, so this is joint work in progress with Constantine Telemann. And the basic question is, if we have a gapped phase, does it admit a gap boundary theory? So gap phase, you should think of a gap system. Perhaps it's a lattice system, a discrete system of the type that's in condensed matter theory. Perhaps it's a quantum field theory even, or even a string theory. And you can always take a boundary theory that lives on the boundary of this theory, and tensor it with another theory just in that dimension that doesn't couple to the bulk. In particular, you can tensor with a gapless theory. So any theory admits gapless boundary theories. And the question is that the only case? Is it forced that the boundary theory is gapped? So condensed matter physicists in particular like to say you have such and such a phase, a theory in the bulk, and then we're forced to have conduction, or we're forced to have massless modes, or we're forced to have something on the boundary. And it's that forced that's the subject of this talk in a particular case. So if you were here yesterday, you'll hear a little bit of a repeat here. We're imagining perhaps that phases are the path components of some moduli space of quantum systems, perhaps with discrete invariants. And the first heuristic in that question is that the answer to this question doesn't change if I move along a path, that it just depends on the phase and not on the particular theory. If I deform the theory without closing the gap, if you like, I stay in this moduli space, then that's the case. And so, as with yesterday's problems, we convert to a field theory by these physical ideas that the deformation class, the phase, is determined by the low energy behavior of the theory, and that if the theory is gapped, then it's well approximated by a topological field theory. So we'll come back and revisit the second one. The second one is problematic. There are these things in condensed matter called fracton phases. So if you think of the system as being defined by a lattice, you don't necessarily have a continuum limit approximation. That's one problem. There's another problem that I'll come back to with that statement. Okay, so if we make these two physical heuristics, then the problem becomes one in topological field theory. Because we have a gap system in the bulk, a gap system in the boundary, we apply this idea, and that says that if that's the case, then you should have, its low energy should be approximated by a topological field theory in the bulk and a topological boundary theory on the boundary. And so given a bulk topological field theory, does it admit a topological boundary theory? And we want one non-zero. So that's the kind of general problem. And I'll talk about a particular instance of that problem. So how do we talk about topological field theories? I think everybody in this audience knows. We talk about it in this language of symmetric monoidal functors from some Bordism category of manifolds, possibly manifolds with extra structure like orientation, spin structure, and so on. And at the top level, we have n-dimensional space times, n minus one-dimensional spaces. This is modeling Wick rotated field theory. So we assign a vector space to every closed n minus one manifold, and a Bordism, we assign a linear map between the corresponding vector spaces. And so that's what a topological field theory is. And so what is a boundary theory? Well, the collection of topological field theories forms a symmetric monoidal category. So we can talk about the objects being these theories, and we can tensor them together by tensoring their values. So that's the notion of stacking systems in condensed matter physics. And we can talk about maps between theories. Map between theories is a natural transformation of functors. Now, if you do that category of symmetric monoidal functions from here to here, you ask about natural transformations, you can prove that they're all invertible. So the only natural transformations are isomorphisms, and that's not an interesting kind of boundary theory. But we can say a boundary theory is a map from the trivial theory to the truncation of F, where I don't ask that the natural transformation respect the morphisms N. They just act on the vector spaces. And, well, without extending the theory, which we'll do shortly, that's a little bit of a thin notion, but the same definition works when we come to extended field theories. But just to show you, you get the kind of object you expect, here's a Bordism from the manifold Y to the empty manifold. That's the manifold X. And so if I evaluate my theory F, the bulk theory, that gives me a linear map from F of Y to the scalars. But now if I paint, so to speak, the boundary with this boundary theory, I can evaluate that on Y. That's a map from, again, the trivial theory, the scalars into F of Y. And so I could compose, and that gives me a complex number. And so the boundary theory functions as capping off the boundary. So it gives us what a closed manifold would have given us in the bulk theory. So that's a boundary theory. So you can think of it as a domain wall from the empty theory to the theory F. All right. Okay. So here's a little toy example to show you why boundary theories might not exist. It's very much a toy mathematical example. Don't try to think about any physics with this. So this is a theory of zero and one dimensional manifolds. I mean, you could try to think of the physics. It's a theory with a global plus minus one symmetry, if you like. And so the manifolds we evaluated on are zero and one dimensional manifolds equipped with a double cover. And so the object, basic object, is a point equipped with this double cover, but that double cover has an automorphism, the deck transformation that flips these. So when we apply the theory, we get a vector space together with an involution. So let's just take the simplest theory, which is non-trivial, which is an invertible theory. It just assigns the complex line as the vector space, but it assigns the non-trivial sign representation. So what's a boundary theory for this? Well, a boundary theory, when I evaluate on that same manifold, would be an invariant vector. And the only invariant vector is zero, so the sign representation. So that's a little example just to show you that non-zero boundary theories may not exist. Okay. Now we have to go back and think about this second heuristic. As I said, there are lots of issues with that. But the one issue is this expectation that we get a topological field theory. And I want to make that a little bit more accurate, because that's what comes up today. And let's look at an example. So the example is not a lattice system, but a field theory. So let's think about three-dimensional Yang-Mills theory with a Chern-Simons term. And so the Chern-Simons term has the effect, if you like, of giving a mass to the gauge field. And if we look at the long distance behavior, that is approximated by Chern-Simons theory as a theory. Now, the original Yang-Mills theory, of course, to write down the Yang-Mills theory, I need a Riemannian metric. It's not at all a topological field theory, clearly. And to write down the Chern-Simons term, I need an orientation. So the background fields for the Yang-Mills plus Chern-Simons are a Riemannian metric and an orientation. And if we want to make a long distance approximation, we might well expect that we have the same background fields. We have approximating a function, we have the same domain. And so indeed, what we see is Chern-Simons theory is a theory of oriented Riemannian manifolds. And if you look at Witten's paper on the Jones polynomial from way back, you'll see that that's there. And in fact, he computes the kind of dependence on the metric. But the dependence on the metric is invertible. So in a sense, this theory is a topological theory, tensor and invertible theory. The invertible theory is not topological. It depends on the metric. But that's, in a sense, a local statement. And to write that down, you have to introduce, and that's what Witten did, you have to introduce a framing. So if you introduce a framing, you can then tensor by the inverse of this invertible field theory, non-topological field theory. And what you get is a topological field theory. But it's a topological field theory of frame manifolds now. So the framing is coming in to eliminate that metric dependence. If you approximate a relativistic theory, you cannot possibly get a frame topological field theory. You have to get something that reflects the relativistic invariance you started with. And that means it has to descend, if you like, to oriented or unoriented manifolds, or perhaps some fancier symmetry group that maps onto those. But so the frame theory doesn't come directly as approximating this. But we're tensoring by this invertible field theory. That's an invertible operation. And any boundary theory, we would think we could also, in a sense, tensor by that. And so our question for this kind of theory becomes, does this Chern-Simons theory as a topological theory of frame manifolds, does this admit a non-zero boundary theory? So that's the question.
Invertible theory.
What's that?
When you say invertible theory, what is the definition of that?
Well, so I said that field theories have a composition law by tensoring. It's associative in the categorical sense, and there's a trivial theory.
Okay.
So that's invertible. Okay. So here we're using these topological, or possibly topological times invertible, to approximate some more complicated system. And saying invertible is just saying the low energy part has a unique state on every space. So that's how we get there. Okay, so when Chern-Simons was introduced, as I said, Witten introduced it, starting from this beautiful object in differential geometry we all know and love, which is the Chern-Simons invariant, was introduced in the early 70s by Chern and Simons, as it happens. But he used the path integral, which is not something, maybe it's something we love, but it's not something we know. And at about the same time, Reshtikin and Taraev introduced what were clearly the same invariants, but they started with some rather complicated, intricate algebraic data, like a quantum group, or more generally, this data that Seiberg and Moore had introduced of a modular tensor category, Moore and Seiberg. So, so it was kind of a question, what did these two things have to do with each other? That was a puzzle at the time. And the resolution is that they both fit into a single picture of an extended field theory. Well, there's more. You have to say how in an extended field theory you start with classical Chern-Simons and compute the modular tensor category, but that's for another time. And so an extended field theory means we not only have numbers attached to closed three manifolds, framed in this case, vector spaces attached to closed two manifolds, but now we're going to factor the vector space. We're going to think of the vector space as depending locally on the two manifold in the sense that we're allowed to cut it along circles. So it's not quite complete locality. We can't quite get to balls yet, but it's another level of locality. And so now our target is two categories. This is a map of two categories. And in particular, the circle maps to a category. So here, this means the two category of linear, complex linear abelian categories. And this category, F of a circle, gets extra structure from the geometry of the manifolds. So this pair of pants with these outgoing, this outgoing becomes a multiplication, and the braiding of the circles tells you you get a braided tensor category. So that's a theme we're going to use more intricately, this idea of using the geometry of these low-dimensional manifolds to induce structure on the images in the field theory. Okay, so just a remark. The actual Chern-Simons theory, what you might call bosonic Chern-Simons theory, factors through a slightly smaller category where we don't have framings, but we have an orientation and a trivialization of the first Pontryagin class. Framing is a little bit more. You also trivialize the second Schiefel-Whitney class and the corresponding four-dimensional class. And when we have the frame theories, which includes what are called spin Chern-Simons theories, then there are actually two circles. So there are two three-frame circles. That corresponds to the fact that framings are a torsor over pi 1, well, maps of the circle into SO3, if I fix the orientation. And there are two of those up to homotopy. So there are two circles, bounding and not bounding. And so the bounding one gives you this algebra-like thing, the modular tensor category, and the non-bounding one gives you a module over it, module category over it. Okay. So now we want to know if this F admits one. And well, it would be better if we could have a fully extended theory. And so I think everyone's familiar with this notion, surely. And so we now want to go down to be able to cut all the way down to points. We have to have a target category that accommodates that. And we have a symmetric monoidal functor like that. And the basic theorem in the subject is was conjecture of Baez and Dolan in 96, who put their finger on the finiteness condition that this enforces, strong finiteness condition called fully dualizable. And the statement is the theory is, in the first instance, determined by its value on a point. So this plus means a point with some fixed framing. And secondly, that if we give a sufficiently finite object, we can construct a theory. And so that's an equivalence.
So what do you assign to points?
Pardon me?
What do you assign?
Well, that's a good question. So in this general picture, we have some target category with the same algebraic structure as the domain. And we could just let it be what it is. Now, in physics, you might think there would be a preferred target, just the same way you would say that that what you assign to a space when you quantize is a complex vector space because of principles of quantum mechanics. And there's not a universal choice for this codomain, C, in general, for what we should do lower down. So one way to view it is that we want to choose something, and that what we're using it for is just to compute. We're really interested in those invariants at the top. So whatever algebra, whatever complicated things I have to do, that's a computational mechanism that's expressing how local these invariants are, but we're only using it to get things at the top. So there's not a universal choice, and indeed in this problem, I'm going to leave it kind of vague.
It's like for chance assignments where if I think of, I don't know if that's the same, of the circle, I assign a Kac-Moody algebra, for instance. So then, what's the substructure below the Kac-Moody algebra?
Well, again, you would assign some category of representations of the Kac-Moody algebra in this theory, something kind of linear. And what you would assign below, there's not a unique answer, and there's probably not even a sort of completely worked out good answer.
Okay.
Another project that we haven't completed is to give such an answer, but it's going to be a formal answer. It's not going to be satisfying. But you might, again, think of it just as an existence proof that you can do that for Chern-Simons, and therefore apply the kinds of theorem, for example, that I'll tell you about today.
Do you think that there will be a fully extended description of Chern-Simons when there are no boundary conditions, no gap boundary conditions?
Yes. Definitely. Okay, so the cobordism hypothesis tells you that the theory is determined by its value on a point, and the same is true for a boundary theory. Boundary theory is also determined by its value on a point. And notice a boundary theory is a map from one to whatever object is attached to a point. So I must say in the past I've mistakenly said that the object attached to a point is the collection of boundary theories. That's incorrect. The correct thing is to say it's Hom from one, the tensor unit, into that. So when you ask whether it's extendable, you have, I think, in the back of your mind, this idea that you're conflating this with the boundary theories. And I want to emphasize, because I think I'm guilty of propagating that misconception, that those are different. And so extending it to a point is not saying that there are boundary theories. You need Hom from one to that. Now, if your ambient category is the category of vector spaces, then this is a vector space, this is the scalars, and we're talking about linear maps from the scalars to a vector space. Well, those are identified with the vectors in the vector space. So in that sense, they're identified. And if you're in the category of categories, the same thing. You get objects in the category. But in general, those are different. For example, if you're in the category of modules over an algebra, if you have the Morita category of an algebra, then a map like this to an algebra is a left module over the algebra. That's different than the algebra. Okay. So this is what we have Chern-Simons so far, or more generally, these Reshtikhin-Taraev theories based on a modular tensor category. And now we want to have a fully extended version. That's what we've been discussing. So I'm going to assume that such a version exists. And then our problem is to characterize two things. We have to first characterize something about this target category. So it's a three category, I'm not going to know, but there are definitely constraints. For example, I want that when I restrict this theory to one, two, and three manifolds, I recover this. Well, that means I have to be recovering this two category of categories inside this bigger category. And so on. So we need some axioms about C to make it realistic. And then we need some axioms about F to say that when I restrict, I get this, and so on. So the theorem that I'm going to tell you about is going to have a lot of conditions that are meant to model turn assignments.
Is it not going to be the three categories, two categories?
No. It's definitely not going to be that. Maybe you could choose it to be that, but I'm not going to fix C. I'm only going to tell you some conditions on C, and then in the future, perhaps. So Andre Enriquez and collaborators have given some proposal, for example, for how you might do this, and there are other ones. And so the idea is that that, or at least the fully dualizable part of it, should satisfy these axioms.
So in that level of star,
yes,
have you like actually picked a level and like the thing assigned to the circle is?
Yeah, I mean, we have a definite theory, so it's based on, if you like, a loop group at a particular level, Kotzmoody at a particular level, or a particular modular tensor category. So we're envisioning that, but some theory like that. Okay, so let me give you an example of these kinds of theories, a very special example, which are called Torayev-Vero theories in the condensed matter people to whom I was talking last week. It's called Levin-Wenn models. And there we do have a good choice for this C, this codomain or target category, which is the three category of tensor categories. So the reason we can do it is because of the work of all these people. And we're definitely leaning on their work. So the theory of tensor categories worked out in many papers of these people. And Theo, who's sitting there, and others proved the theorems that let you construct this three category and know what. For example, that fusion categories are fully dualizable, which I think is the next statement. And so if we have a fusion category, which is a kind of finite tensor category of a particular type, then by the cobordism hypothesis, we can make a field theory. And so that's not starting with the modular tensor category, which we attach to the circle. That's starting with the category, this fusion category that we attach to a point. And that gives us a field theory with a particular target of tensor categories. And now we could compute what we get for the circle. That's the modular tensor category. Again, there are two circles. So for the bounding one, we get this modular tensor category, which is then the Drinfeld center of this category.
So can you say a bit more what you're saying to the points there?
Well, it's called a fusion category. So if you want an example, supposing I give you a finite group. So we can make an algebra by looking at functions on the finite group, say, to the complex numbers. And then that becomes an algebra by convolving. So that's, in a sense, the group algebra, or group ring, with coefficients in the complex numbers. Now let's take, instead of complex numbers, let's take vector spaces. So I'm going to assign to each group element a vector space, which is to say I have a vector bundle over this finite group. And we can still convolve. Multiplication and addition get replaced by tensor product and direct sum. So that's an example of a fusion category. And that theory corresponds to finite gauge theory. It would be what you get by quantizing, if you like, just G bundles, finite G bundles, with no weights. We could put weights in there too and get the Dyckgraff-Witten theory.
Is the thing that fusion categories are the fully dualizable objects in the three category tensor categories?
No. They're not all of them.
They're definitely not all of them.
I think the correct statement, by the way, is that if it's three dualizable and it's two dualizable as a left module category over itself, then it's fusion. I think that's the correct statement that characterizes them. But anyway, the only one we use is that a fusion category does give a theory. It is three dualizable. Yes?
You say the same as saying if it has a topological boundary condition?
Not it has. It's I'm about to say that. It's its own canonical boundary condition. Yes. Yes, if that thing does satisfy for a tensor category the finiteness to be a boundary theory, then it's a fusion category. I think that's the correct statement. But we haven't written down the proof
yet. Are there any examples of things, fully dualizable objects in this tensor category, which is not a fusion?
Sure. I mean, if an object is three dualizable, so is any equivalent, in this case, Mereed equivalent object. But the Mereed equivalent, you know, for example, the scalars, you know, going down a level in the algebra, the scalars as an algebra is Mereed equivalent to n by n matrices. But if you think of the boundary theory, they're very different, the one for the scalars and the one for the n by n matrices. So you could imagine instead going to, say, compact operators on a Hilbert space or something where you wouldn't have the finiteness.
So you could do multi-fusional categories into the fusional categories, but anything?
No, I think there's...
There are dualizable tensor categories which are not semisimple.
Yes. Yeah, so I think there are different ways that can fail. And I should have been saying multi-fusion, I think, instead of fusion everywhere. But for the talk, I'm leaving off the multi. All right, so as I said, the, having a tensor category is like having an algebra, and in particular, a map from one to a map in the three category of tensor categories, one morphism, from the trivial tensor category, which is vect, rather the unit tensor category, into your tensor category T is a left module category. And any tensor category is a module over itself. For a fusion category, it's finite enough to define a theory. And so there is a non-zero boundary theory for every Torreyev Vero theory. And the theorem is essentially that's the only case. That if you have a non-zero boundary theory, that's here, then essentially you started with a fusion category. That's what it says. But as I promised you, there are hypotheses that have to axiomatize C, have to axiomatize F, and then we can get the conclusion. So let's see a little bit what these axioms are, and then I'll spend the rest of the time sketching just a few ideas that go into the proof.
Can I ask a slightly philosophical question? So somehow fusion category, notion of fusion category roles, if I'm saying correctly, assumes simplicity, right? So
the, yes.
So which kind of, at least kind of philosophically, I don't think about that as a finiteness condition. So there's a kind of finiteness and semi-simplicity, but you're saying that you get the semi-simplicity here sort of automatically.
Yes. So even if we have a two-dimensional theory, supposing we have a two-dimensional theory whose values are in categories, so we assign a category to a point, then if it's really a theory, meaning that category is two dualizable, then that category is semi-simple. That's a consequence. The first theorem, of course, is in one dimension. If we have a vector space attached to a point, we have a theory of values in vector space, then the vector space is literally finite dimensional. That's the, and so the first analog of that, if you take the target category, the codomain to be linear categories, then the theorem is it's semi-simple. So that semi-simplicity is a kind of finiteness already there. And in fact, we'll use that. Yeah, it's a good time for other questions before I explain the theorem.
I don't understand why B is a condition, but maybe you'll talk about that when you talk about the conditions.
Yeah, I'm not there yet. Okay, so so let's go through these conditions. So one is that the target category, this three category that we're not specifying, it at least contains tensor categories, because, for example, we want to include the Torreyev-Vero theories, and it contains tensor categories as a full subcategory, which means that if I have a map in that category C between two tensor categories, then that map also lies in tensor categories, which means it's a bimodule. So we're assuming that. Then we're assuming, that omega C, so what is omega C? Omega C means the endomorphisms from the identity object to itself, the Homs from the identity object to itself, which in the Bordism category means the Bordisms from the empty zero manifold to itself, like the circle. And what it means is that we're truncating the Bordism category to 1, 2, and 3 manifolds, and so this is the analog of doing that in the codomain. And we know when we truncate to 1, 2, and 3 manifolds, we want to recover the Reshetic and Torreyev theory, which has values in this two category of abelian linear categories. And so we assume that about C, that that is what end of 1 is. Now, what about F? Well, if I take a Reshetic and Torreyev theory, then there's a way to double it. So in the unitary case, you would think of tensoring it with its complex conjugate. And that's a way to get a Torreyevero theory. That's a standard kind of construction. And you see, if I evaluate a theory on S-naught, S-naught is the disjoint union. The zero sphere is the disjoint union of a plus point and a minus point. And so there is a theory whose value on the plus point is what this theory F has on the minus point. And so taking F of S-naught is what you would attach to a point in the doubled theory, the kind of norm squared theory. And so we want that to be a Torreyevero type theory. And so for that theory, this is a fusion category. So we're going to assume that F of S naught is in fact a fusion category.
Epsilon simplicity is one of the requirements.
Yes. Yeah, I'm definitely modeling this Rashtigan Torreyev. So of course, to get the conclusion, we have to have this built in, no doubt. But okay. And then the Rashtigan Torreyev theory evaluated on a circle, that's already included, it's a closed one manifold. On the bounding circle, we know we get a modular tensor category. And a modular tensor category is a braided tensor category. I showed you the picture that shows you it's braided. Braided tensor categories form a four category. And a modular tensor category is invertible inside that four category. And so we're going to assume that this thing is invertible as an object in this four category of braided tensor categories. So that's, in a sense, modeling the hypothesis that we start with a modular tensor category. So these are meant to be, to characterize, in a sense, or at least capture what these Rashtigan Torreyev or Chern-Simon, Witten, whatever theories are. OK? Yes?
So for like Andre Enriquez's suggestion of what you assign to the point, does it assign to S0 a fusion category?
So I'm not totally sure. I haven't absorbed that. It's a good question. I'm not sure if it does. I think it does. If it doesn't, then we have to ask, did he really reproduce Chern-Simons, right? I mean, I was trying to motivate these by just kind of basic properties of what Chern-Simons is. OK, any other questions?
Sorry, when you say F0 is a fusion category,
mm-hmm.
you mean it sits inside this copy of T cat C?
Exactly. So it's an object. This is a zero manifold. So it maps to an object of the codomain, wherever it is, C. This is our theory. So it maps to an object here. And this contains as a full subcategory tensor categories. And so I'm saying it lives in that full subcategory. Absolutely. Yes.
If Andre's functor satisfies A, the Mensa theorem, it's not obvious from Andre's construction.
Did you have a question?
Answering Mark's question.
No, but before you.
I had misread the statement.
OK. So those are the hypotheses. Oh, well, any other questions? OK, so those are the hypotheses. And now what's the conclusion? Well, there's one more hypothesis. This is the hypothesis that C and F includes C as its codomain, capture Rashtigan Torreyev type theory. And now the main hypothesis is that there's a non-zero boundary theory. And given that, we want to say that, in fact, the modular tensor category, in other words, the value of F on the bounding circle, is actually the Drinfeld center of a fusion category. I've given it the funny name T of plus. And we could say what the non-bounding circle is. It's a module over it. It will be the Drinfeld cocenter. So this is Hochschild cohomology, Hochschild homology. OK.
Can you recall what B and N means?
Bounding and not bounding. So that's a unique way to tell you about the framing or spin structure on the circle. It's an unambiguous way to tell you. If I say trivial, non-trivial, or tap some names, it's not so clear. But bounding and not bounding is absolutely unambiguous. OK, other questions?
So maybe this is about what you're about to say, but in most of the interesting Rashtigan Torreyev situations, center, right?
Yes, thank you. I probably would have forgotten to say that. Yes, so we could ask, when is a modular tensor category a Drinfeld center? Or if you like, for which groups and levels is the corresponding modular tensor category a Drinfeld center? And typically it's not. So if you take, you know, U1 at any level, that's not. If you take SUN at any level, it's not. If you take a finite group and you're allowed to twist, then it is. And I told you in the air what the fusion category is in that case, at least in the untwisted case. There are certain theories for tori, for example, U1 cross U1, where it is the Drinfeld center. But for general theory, it's not. There's a algebraic gadget that's introduced called the Witt group in this situation for these braided tensor categories that's supposed to measure whether or not it's a Drinfeld center. And what this theorem says in those terms is that it's the value in the Witt group is the only obstruction to having a non-zero boundary theory. That's the complete obstruction. So that's a way to say it. But an informal way to say it is that the only theories that have it are the tori of Vero theories. Those are the only ones that admit a non-zero boundary theory. Other questions before I turn off the slides? Okay. Let's see how we do this.
So this goes back to a question I had before. But
maybe the lights.
Still thinking about it. So if you had one of the examples of you can try out for a certain.
Sorry, now that that's there, you have to talk louder.
Oh, sorry. So the assumption that f of s zero is a fusion category, in the standard cases where you have like a group and a level, what's the corresponding fusion category that you associate to s zero? Is it just the category itself?
It'll end up being equivalent to the modular tensor category. Are there more lights? Oh, that was the wrong one. Oh. See that if it's all the way up there? Yes, if there were lights. What?
Yeah.
Or should I put it in the middle?
Middle.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of glary up there.
Yeah.
Actually, let's do this. Better. Okay, so that's the theorem that was on the slide, just so you have it during the rest of the lecture. So what I'm going to try to do is just indicate a little bit how it's proved. It's not the most difficult theorem in the world, but I just want to show you the power of saying that we have a field theory and how we use the Bordism category to do that. So I want to maybe start by just telling, because I always get confused, about how one works in the Bordism category. And the first thing to say is that we have arrows of time. So what do I mean by having arrows of time? Well, if we have a Bordism, then we have to decide. If it's at the top level, we have to decide which boundary components are incoming, part of the domain of the Bordism, which ones are outgoing. In other words, this X is a map in the Bordism category from Y0 to Y1, where the boundary is the union of Y0 and Y1. And so we give kind of arrows that tell us which ones are incoming and which ones are outgoing. Now, you know, what does that really mean? It means that an object in the category, say Y1 or something, is an n minus one dimensional manifold if we're in n dimensions. Here it's a two manifold. But you should think of that two-manifold as living inside a germ of a three-manifold. So if we were doing quantum field theory that depended on metrics, we would really have a metric on the germ. And we might also have other fields that live in n dimensions, like spinner fields and this and that. And you really need them to be in n dimensions. You don't know what a particular type of spinner field in n dimensions looks like in n minus 1. So you should always think that these manifolds of lower dimension are thickened up. In the topological world, we don't have to thicken the manifold. We just have to thicken the tangent bundle. And so we have a trivial bundle, say, plus the tangent bundle of this y. And this is the thing that we have. So in particular, we have this trivial line. And that trivial bundle is, in a sense, what this arrow is. That's what that indicates. And now, when I say that I have a morphism like this from this object, I have to give a diffeomorphism of this object, or think a little tubular neighborhood of it, thickening of it. I have to give a diffeomorphism of that with a thickening of a little piece of the boundary. And depending on where that points, that tells me whether it's incoming or outgoing. And so that's the kind of arrow of time that you always have. And that gets a little bit more complicated when you have objects of lower dimension. So if, say, in our three-dimensional theory, we have a one-manifold, then we have two extra directions. And so we have two arrows of time. And so our one-manifold might sit at the corner of some bordism. And you see we'll have some two arrows that tell us, arrow one and arrow two, that tell us inside this one morphism is this thing incoming or outgoing, and as this thing sits in here, is it incoming or outgoing? So, so that's all. I mean, in a three-dimensional theory, that would have been across the circle. So we have to keep track of those, and that's one thing. Now, what about the framings? Well, whatever structure you have on your manifold, your tangential structure, it lives in n dimensions, in this case in three dimensions. And so it's living in this thickened version, or it's living on this stabilized tangent bundle. And so a framing is then a trivialization of this, this stabilized tangent bundle. So that's a three framing. But the three framing is not lined up with these arrows of time. The three-framing can rotate. So if I frame a two-manifold inside a three-manifold, or inside a three-dimensional theory, it's not true that two of the vectors have to be tangent. It's just a trivial framing of the stabilized bundle. Now, on the other hand, if we have a boundary theory, well, beta maps 1 to F. We could also have boundary theories, say beta prime, that map F to 1. So we have two different kinds of boundary theories. And when we have a boundary theory, we have to then adapt the tangential structure a little bit. So in this framed case, this beta is only two dualizable. And that means it only really lives on two framed manifolds. So when we're sitting at the boundary, and I'll use green, the color of the boundary theory, then if that's sitting on the boundary, and this is a three-manifold, then if I'm putting beta here, which maps 1 to F, then I'll want that the in my framing, I'll want that the first vector points normally, say, to the manifold, and the other two vectors point tangent. And so that's essentially a two-framing on the boundary. So we can't use an arbitrary three-framing on the boundary because this beta is only two dualizable. So we have to line that up. So, so those are the rules of the road. And the pictures I'll draw will be sitting in the plane. They'll be sitting in the plane of the blackboard. And so and I'm just going to draw two-frame pictures. And so the third framing will just come out. I'm not going to be talking about three manifolds. I'm going to be talking about very low dimensional, 0, 1, and 2 manifolds. And so the third framing will just, by convention, come out. And so we need to fix a plus point. We need to fix a minus point. And wherever they occur, I'll have them changed by translation. So I'm going to draw a framing. but we're going to have to line up that framing with these model objects. And so I can just do that if I always align the framing. Otherwise, I'll have an ambiguity of how I arrive there by the topology of the orthogonal group. So the plus point, the framing I want is this one, where the first vector is here. I'll stop labeling them. And the second vector is here. That's supposed to be red. And here, that's the second vector. That's the first vector. So that's the minus point. OK. So that's that. So just to warm you up, so here's a manifold E. This is going to be the interval as a manifold. But we're going to look at it as a bordism. And so this is E. It's going to be a map from S naught to the tensor unit, which is the empty zero manifold. And now I have to tell you how it's framed, for example. And so how it's framed is that one, that one, that one. And I think if I draw these pictures, you'll fall asleep. But you see that the framing turns 180 degrees as we go across. And now I have to tell you how these arrows of time are purple. So this thing, as it sits in a two-manifold, it's going incoming. I have to tell you that. So that interacts with the framing, that choice. And then the second arrow is telling me these are both incoming. So that's why it's an evaluation from this is the plus point, that's the minus point, and it maps me to nothing. So this is a picture. So I find it convenient not to always draw these things from left to right or right to left, but to use these arrows. That leads to much simpler pictures and more transparent way to work with these things. OK. So that's part of a duality, which is part of the finiteness of saying that the plus point and the minus point are dual to each other. That's called the evaluation map. And there's a co-evaluation map. But again, you have to be careful of the framing. And not only is there a co-evaluation map, but there are adjoints of this, this evaluation map. There are, in principle, right adjoints and left adjoints. So it's the last 10 minutes, so I can accelerate the prerequisites. So if you've worked with these kinds of categories, then you know what I'm talking about. And in the world of two framings, then you know there's a whole Z's worth of two framings, because I can always put a full twist of the framing in the middle. In the world of three framings, so that has to do with pi 1 of SO2. In the world of three framings, we're talking about pi 1 of SO3, which is only remembers the mod 2 number of twists. So there are only two of them. And so as it happens, the co-evaluation is one kind of picture. And the two left and right adjoints are the same as each other as three framings. They differ by two units as two framings. But they're both different from that one, from the co-evaluation, sorry. So maybe I should draw a picture. So for example, the right adjoint, even correct, I hope, as a two-frame thing. So this would map the empty back to S naught. And that would have a picture in this language that looks something like this. OK, collecting many pieces of chalk here. I don't know if you can see these things. So that's part of the information. Then I have to tell you that this is still pointing down. And now these things are pointing out. And right, so you can figure out which is the plus point and which is the minus point. This one is the minus point, and that one's the plus point. And you can check that it's the right adjoint, because you need a map from the composition of the right adjoint from E composed with ER. You need a map from that into the trivial one, which means they have to glue to a circle. And you have to have that circle incoming. And the framing you get has to, on the circle has to be the one that extends. So you have to work that out. You have to think carefully about gluing. You have to think about these arrows. And so this is all just to tell you it's a little bit finicky to work with frame manifolds. But remember, the framings came ultimately because these theories, you know, what we're approximating, when we really approximated, it still had this metric dependence. We had to get rid of it by introducing the framing, and now we're paying for it by having to keep track of those framings. All right, so that's a little bit about the kind of calculus, if you like, of these things. Right, so what's one kind of conclusion you could make? Well, for example, in the Bordism category, we have that the bounding circle is E composed with ER, the right adjoint. I just said that. And in this three-frame world, the right adjoint, left adjoint are the same. And right. And now this E, I'll just write it again, as I said, is a map from S0 into the empty manifold. So let's look at what F of E is. F of E is a map from F of S0 into, well, this maps to the tensor unit because F is a homomorphism. It takes tensor unit to tensor unit. But remember, our hypothesis is that F of S naught is a tensor category. And this, of course, is the unit, lives in tensor categories as well. So both of these objects live inside this copy of TCAT that's sitting inside C. And we said it's a full subcategory, which means, therefore, the map also sits inside TCAT. And the map inside TCAT is a module. So this thing is equal to, say, ME, which is a left, right module, well, module category over the tensor category F of S naught. Okay? So that's what E is. But now we can apply F to this equation. And so, for example, F of the bounding circle then is equivalent as a category because these evaluate to categories. So that's, again, a hypothesis, this second hypothesis that omega C is equivalent to cat C. This is equivalent as a category to the composition here. Compositions go to composition. And adjoints have to go to adjoints. And so what is this composition inside tensor categories? Well, it's just, it's this thing as a category. Why did I write it? It's sort of ME, well, it's right adjoint, say, which we could compute, tensor over F of S naught with ME. And that's the same as endomorphisms over F of S naught of ME. So it's saying that F of the circle is end of that. And what this allows you to conclude, I think, so that implies that F of S naught, this tensor category, is Morita equivalent to F of S1b. So that was one of your questions. How does F of S naught relate to the modular tensor category? And so it's Morita equivalent. I mean, F of S naught, in the usual way, S naught maps to an algebra. So this is a tensor category. And as tensor categories, those are Morita equivalent. And it also says that F of S1 bounding acts on ME. Well, just by that formula, you see it acts on ME. Okay, so that's just a flavor. And the basic definition, well, we have to produce, given this boundary theory, we have to produce this fusion category, T of plus. And so let's define T of plus. It will be F applied to a certain morphism, well, picture in the Bordism category. Right. So what is the picture? Well, the picture is, again, the interval. But now on each end of the interval, I'm going to put the boundary condition beta. So the green dot means I've put beta on the boundaries. Now we have to frame this. So this is behaving as if it's a closed one manifold because of the boundary theories. I hope you can tell that's green. And again, the direction is going to be like that. And the framing is going to do this. It's going to be the one we've seen. And notice it has the property that this blue arrow is pointing in, which I said was necessary when we had the boundary theory, that we had to have, say, the first vector pointing in if we're going to color it with beta, which maps 1, the empty theory, to F. So that first one has to point in. OK. Well, now we could see what this is just by doing some maneuvers in the Bordism category. For example, we can write this as, we can write it as just gluing together these two pieces with appropriate framings. And here I would want to use, for this one, I would want to use a constant framing here, and then the framing here that rotates. On the other hand, that's one kind of decomposition. Second kind of decomposition, we could make it into three pieces with framings.
The green color, the
green does not show up, by the way.
The green does not, yeah, I know. I want a better colored chunk. So.
Just a question, do you have to put the same boundary condition on the left point on the right?
Ah. No, you don't in general. In this problem, I've only given one boundary theory. It's beta. But I had to use the framing that pointed in. Okay. So here we could break it up in a different way. And here we would want something constant on the one that rotates. So this is a copy of E, which is the one that was up there somewhere. And then we want the one that's constant here. And so these lead to two expressions. One expression is that this tells you that E plus is equivalent to, well, if you evaluate these, you'll find it's Hom from 1 to beta plus, right adjoint, composed with beta plus, which is the same as N beta plus. And that expression makes obvious that it's a tensor category. But if we do it this way, then we get a different expression, which is that it's also this right module tensor over f of s naught with beta of s naught. And if you remember that ME was executing this Morita equivalence, then this is really transforming beta of s naught to t plus under the Morita equivalence. That's what it says. All right. So I just wanted to give you a flavor for the kinds of maneuvers. You can show in pictures, just directly from here without decomposing, that this guy is a tensor category. We could write down the multiplication. It's a kind of standard picture where we would write two copies of T on the top, one copy on the bottom. So this is T of plus, that's T of plus, that's T of plus. This green, which you can't tell it's green, but now you can. This green is the boundary theory. And now we just have to check that the framing actually extends here. So it's all a question of these framings. And then this defines a multiplication, two copies of T to T. You can check that it's a unital multiplication, again, by checking a framing and so on. So there are a lot of tedious or fun, depending on how you think, checks that have to go into that. So. Right. So one more thing to say is, okay, so we have this T, we show it's a tensor category by constructing it that way. It's first a category, we define its multiplication. Now we want to show its fusion, so we have to show it's semi-simple and all that. How do we show it's semi-simple? Well, I'd like to consider the dimensional reduction of this theory along the interval, and that dimensional reduction will be a two-dimensional theory with values in cat C, whose value on a point is this category. And then I already told you that such a category is semi-simple. But I can't dimensionally reduce along this because this is a two-framing. See, I can't multiply a two-manifold with a two-framing by this one because I'd have a four-framing. And I only have a three-frame theory. So here we have to do a little bit of a trick, which is along the lines of your question, we introduce another boundary theory, which is the adjoint that we already have. So beta plus adjoint is a boundary theory that goes the other way. You see, and if it goes the other way, then we can put beta at one end of the interval. We could put beta adjoint at the other. And now we could just frame the interval by a one framing, which is simply constant. You see, now this is pointing out. So this is mapping f to 1. This is mapping 1 to f. And that's the same category by the formula there. So inside categories, Hom from 1 to a category is identified with the category. And so we can now dimensionally reduce and deduce it semi-simple. Anyway, that's the flavor of the thing. I didn't get to the meat of the argument, but I think in view of the time, maybe that's enough. Thanks. Questions? Yeah.
So do you know, I missed it if you did said it so already, do you know that this fusion category constructs T of plus is Morita is somehow equivalent to whatever F originally assigned to it? You started with F assigning something in your three category tool.
No, I think it's not necessarily. It's not necessarily equivalent. Yeah, I think it's not necessarily equivalent. So as I say, I think we have a way of illustrating how to formally really write Chern-Simons as a fully extended theory, essentially by starting with tensor categories and adjoining an indeterminate to the codomain and mapping the point to this indeterminate. Now, that indeterminate won't have any maps from 1. It's not going to see that. But if I happen to start with a Torreya-Vero theory, you see, so there would exist such a thing. But in my particular target category, I don't know anything. I haven't assumed anything about Homs from the tensor category part of it outside. So there's no way I could possibly prove that I had such an arrow in my category. That's just not part of the setup. And indeed, as I say, I think. Yeah?
Sorry, so how can we reach the gapless boundary of the just one dimensional function Samos as an abstract of the seminar?
As a what?
As in the abstract of this seminar, yeah.
Oh, what did I write in the abstract?
Shown on the board. And you said it would say the 2 plus 1 dimensional function Samos admit only gapless boundary.
Right. So the logic is that if we start with, say, SU2 at level n, something that definitely doesn't satisfy the conclusion of this, then the contrapositive tells me that we cannot have a non-zero boundary theory in this topological theory. So the argument is, supposing there were a gapped boundary theory in the physical setting. And,
I see. So these natural transformations only describe gapped boundaries?
Well, yes. So the whole thing to reduce to this topological field theory was assuming that there was a gapped boundary theory. If there's a gapless boundary theory, then you would think that's approximated by a conformal field theory, something like this, but not this. Yeah.
So the boundary condition in the theorem can be arbitrarily framed.
Pardon me?
Boundary condition in the theorem can be arbitrarily framed.
Arbitrarily framed.
Can be framed. I mean, it does not need to be orientable.
Yeah, I mean, right.
In a sense, this proves the theorem. This means that breaking Lorentz symmetry is not going to help me making a gapped boundary condition.
No, I mean, the theorem is that the boundary, the hypothesis is the boundary theory is two-framed. I mean, that's what that means. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it might factor through something else, but in principle, it's two-framed.
something, but suppose you can see the theories without framing. I mean, just logical theories. Then extended theories. And how something attached to a point, and then you have something attached to a circle, and the latter is always at the center of the former. Right? Now you're saying that in the framed case, a priori you have no relation. Right? Is that?
Well, I mean, the latter is the Drinfeld center. That depends on what your target category is, doesn't it? I mean, the latter is some kind of Hochschild cohomology,
yeah, okay,
or homology in your category, but I don't think.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, but you're saying that, are you saying that in the frame case, a priori, there's no such relation?
No, in the frame case, there is a relation. It's just we have.
It's the same thing that you don't know how to compute Hochschild homology in this unknown three category. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying that it's true that you'll get some Hochschild cohomology, but it won't be the Hochschild cohomology of a fusion category. That's what I'm saying. It'll be the Hochschild cohomology of something that lives, presumably, in C, in a part that's not seen by tensor category, so the part we haven't axiomatized. So that relation will still hold. That's a general relation about crossing with the circle. But it's happening in a different part. It's not happening in and it's not the Drinfeld center of a fusion category, which is the ones that model these Torreira-Vero theories. Does that make sense? See, we want to know that the object.
I see.
The theory is determined by what's attached to a point. So that's some object in C. And the conclusion is that if we have this boundary theory, that that object is connected, equivalent to something in tensor categories that's finite, this fusion category. But in general, there's something there, but it's not connected.
In other words, so are you saying that somehow it might happen if Q is different from Torreira-Vero, but it can only be different dimension zero at all dimensions?
Well, I mean, I said it was a Reshtikin-Torreyev type theory in one, two, and three dimensions. I mean, Torreira-Vero, it still has the property that you evaluate on a circle. It's still the Drinfeld center of a fusion category. It doesn't share that property. So these Reshtikin-Torreyev, like Chern-Simons, all these Chern-Simons theories are.
If there is a non-zero boundary theory, then you're saying that.
If there's a non-zero boundary theory, it had to be Torreira-Vero, essentially, or equivalent to Torreira-Vero.
This is what you're saying. It's about that you don't know a priori what happens on level zero, but above level zero is about masculine.
Yes, and it extends, well, and we're saying that, up to equivalence, that the whole theory is equivalent to the theory where I take T plus, which I prove is a fusion category. I haven't sketched all the proof, but when we prove it's a fusion category, then immediately we have a theory T, whose value on plus, that's why it's called T of plus, is this fusion category. So that theory T is a Torreira-Vero theory, and then what the theorem says is that our theory is equivalent to the theory T. I mean, maybe it assigns an object in C that wasn't in this tensor category, but it's equivalent. Yeah. So that's what the theorem says. Yeah.
Fusion category question. One of the easiest ways to know that a modular tensor category is not a Drinfeld center is if its central charge is non-zero, what a. But the Witt group of modular tensor categories is like infinitely generated. I mean, there's a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a kind of Fordism way of accessing any of those other abstractions?
No.
Or like understanding them?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that. It's a good question, but yeah.
So you can formulate the Reshtikin-Torreyev type ones, as you said, not just in frame, but in oriented with a P1 trivialization. Do you think working just with the frame case is any fundamentally different, or if you took into account whatever the induced tangential structure on the boundary is?
I'm guessing you might be able to prove that. I mean, also, if you want to do the spin theories, then you should put some gratings in the codomain, which I didn't put right.
Mm-hmm.
So, a more satisfying version would be to say that, in fact, it's a spherical fusion category that you get SO3 invariance. But it's a conjecture even that it always exists. But the fact that the Drinfeld center has that kind of invariance being a modular tensor category, maybe that implies that. But those things aren't known, but you know, these techniques, I don't think will get you there. So yes, it's an excellent question. I think that there are sharper versions that are probably true. I welcome someone tackling those sharper versions. We just wanted to give some version that gives the spirit of that, but it's not the last statement that one could make. Yeah.
One question. So what do you think will happen if you drop the requirement that all the categories are additive?
That's also an excellent question. If we just assume they're additive, yeah, that's... Yeah. Oh, I see. You want to do a derived version. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how that would look. I mean, I don't think you have this more rigid theory that Ettinghoff and company made for fusion categories and so on in that setting. I don't know it in any case. So, I mean, again, great if someone wants to investigate that. We didn't think in that direction.